by all indications, they have small numbers of CIA and other special ops folks on the ground. But they're going to have to increase those numbers if they're going to win.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but I want to thank you again. Again, that's the voice of Reese Ehrlich.
And there you go, Flashpoints this morning on KBOO Portland, a minute before 11 o'clock, and we're about a half hour away from Patricia Welsh, O.B. Hill, and Emma Jackson Ford hosting Black Book Talk, a monthly program featuring interviews and discussions of works by African American authors. Coming up next, though, it's Between the Covers, and today host David Naiman speaks with the award-winning writer Rebecca Mackay. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
Hi, this is John Schock, host of Religion for Life. We all remember Mr. Rogers, the peaceful guy with the sweater and the tennis shoes and Welcome to My Neighborhood. But he was countercultural and a fierce peacemaker. Author Michael G. Long has written Peaceful Neighbor, discovering the countercultural Mr. Rogers. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Aurora Colony Vineyards 2015 Jazz Festival, August 9th, with doors opening at 2 p.m. and performances from 3 to 9 p.m. The Aurora Colony Vineyards is located at 21338 Oak Lane Northeast in Aurora, Oregon. Performers include Tony Lincoln, the Ron Steen Band, Picante Latin Jazz, Tom Grant, and many more. Again, that's the Aurora Colony Vineyards Jazz Festival, August 9th, from 2 to 9 p.m. More information about directions and ticket prices can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Rebecca Mackay, is the author of two novels. Her first, The Borrower, was a book list top 10 debut, an Indie Next pick, an O Magazine selection, and one of Chicago Magazine's choices for best fiction in 2011. Her second book, The 100-Year House, just now out in paperback, received star reviews from Publishers Weekly, Booklist, Library Journal, and Shelf Awareness. Mackay's stories and essays appear regularly in places like Harper's, Tin House, The Wall Street Journal, and on This American Life and Selected Shorts. And her stories have been anthologized in New Stories from the Midwest, Best American Non-Required Reading, and Best American Fantasy, and quite remarkably have been included in four consecutive years of Best American Short Stories. Rebecca Mackay is here today to talk about her short stories, about her first story collection, Music for Wartime, a book everyone from the Chicago Tribune to BuzzFeed to the Huffington Post have called a must-read for the summer. Welcome to Between the Covers, Rebecca Mackay.
Thank you.
These stories, these 17 stories you've written over the course of 13 years, I get the sense that it's not just a snapshot of your evolution as a writer, but that it has been shaped in a different way than just here are the best stories I wrote in 13 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And part of the reason that I didn't have a collection until now was originally I just couldn't see how they could cohere as a collection. I could have put out a stack of stories that I wrote and put a title on it. But I feel like a collection needs to come together in the same way a really great album does. Back when we listened to albums, entire albums of music, you know, like there's a progression, there's a story, they speak to each other. And although they're not all about the same person or anything like that, it's not a linked collection. They're themed. They circle around some of the same themes. And so partly, I was going back to really early stories and revising them to fit what my aesthetic is now and also what the collection needed. A little bit towards the end, I was writing for the collection, seeing what pieces were missing. And I was trying to draw out the ways the stories spoke to each other.
So were there perfectly good standalone stories, successful standalone stories that didn't make the collection simply because
oh, yeah.
you got an idea for what the collection was.
Yeah, exactly. Or ones that like they might have fit in kind of, but not really. There was a story that I was sad to see go. You know, and they'll be in my next collection. But there was one that was published in Tin House last year or this year called K-I-S-S-I-N-G. And I loved that story. And it was about a musician. It was about a drummer in a rock band. And I really wanted it to fit in the collection. And it just didn't. It was about music, but it didn't speak to the other stories. It just wasn't the right fit. So it's going in the next one.
Well, tell us about some of the through lines that you tried to draw out in some of your earlier stories or that you wrote towards in the stories that you wrote specifically with the collection in mind.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's all there in the title, Music for Wartime. The idea there is, I mean, partly, I like that it sounds like an album title in a way, like, you know, some old LP you'd find on your grandparents' shelf. But the themes of not just music, but the arts, and not just war, but conflict, go throughout them. So what the collection is doing is asking the question of what it means to be an artist, to be trying to make art, to make something beautiful in a conflicted and inhospitable world.
Well, let me ask you about that a little further, because you include an epigram at the beginning of a poem called Consulting an Elder Poet on an Anti-War Poem. And the poem itself is contemplating what, if anything, poetry can do in right. a time of war. Does it have any tangible influence as art in the world of action? So what are your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts as a writer in terms of art in a time of war or in a time of conflict?
I mean, I think it's a mode of survival, and it's also why we survive, you know, why we want to survive. It's what we're surviving for in many cases. And I don't just mean, you know, plenty of people need to survive a war and are not making art. But what I mean is we're surviving because there is beauty yet to find, whether that's beauty that we are making or that we're finding in, you know, our family, whatever it is. You know, I mean, for me, my family background, which I write about quite a bit in this book, there are some pieces in here that are kind of explicitly autobiographical about my father's family in Hungary in the 1930s. This was the, you know, the sort of the legacy that I grew up with was my grandmother was a novelist in Hungary. She wrote something like 40 novels in Hungarian. And she was writing under this really oppressive communist regime. She was kind of chose to write historical fiction so that she could be political and no one would call her out on it. But she also wrote things that were modern, that were overtly political, that she couldn't publish. And my mother, who's American, the first time she went into Hungary, and this is something I write about in the book, she went into Hungary alone because my father couldn't go back in to meet her future mother-in-law, which, you know, kind of terrifying to begin with, like go meet your future and mother-in-law alone in a communist country. And when she left, my grandmother gave her, I think in the book I said one, it was actually two manuscripts to smuggle out in her girdle on the train. And it's like onion skin pages. And then they were published something like 30 years later after my grandmother was dead, after the Iron Curtain came down. So, I mean, that's the thing. Like that to me is the idea of how important art is. This is what I grew up with. And I think we don't really get that until it's threatened. You know, where we are happily exercising our free speech, blithely, often unaware, consciously, that there are people who not only, you know, would die for that, but are dying for that.
And is it right? What I remember reading about your grandmother, that she's quite a figure in Hungary. There's a small museum. They celebrate the anniversary of her birth.
Yeah, there was like a big centennial thing. Yeah. Wow.
Did she choose those specific manuscripts to have smuggled out because of what she'd imagined would happen to those stories if she were to publish
them? They
were
unpublishable. They were, one of them, it's the translated title in English is The Accused. And it's the only one that I've read, actually, because I don't read Hungarian. My father translated this one for me. You know, it's about a guy struggling to survive in what was at that point contemporary Hungary, and very political and very critical of communism. There was no way that she could that she could write that. I mean, she throughout her career, she was threatened. She was sued. She was she went into hiding at different points. There was a point early on where she was just living in a different house every night and sent my father somewhere else to be safe. She was barely staying out of trouble.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to author Rebecca Mackay about her short story collection, Music for Wartime. Well, one of the things that I really love about this collection is your inclusion of your family stories. And you have four out of the 17 stories. There are stories that are contemporary, funny stories, and there are magical realist stories that are both contemporary or not. And then there are interspersed these four family legends that I believe you originally published as nonfiction.
Yeah.
But here you're publishing them as stories. There's questions about the stories. You're interrogating these legends. How much are these legends true? Am I learning everything that there really is? Can you tell us about that interrogation that you're doing with them, both within the narrative and then outside of the narrative?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are three stories that are called legends, and then there's this other one that's kind of wrapping it all up. But the three legends are basically stories that I've been trying to write since literally high school. All three of them. There's the story of my grandmother poisoning a soldier with a bottle of ink. There's a story about her painting women's faces to make them look old so they wouldn't get raped by soldiers as they did resistance work. And there's this story about when I was a baby and this bird flew in our house and it was the last time my grandparents saw each other. All three of those I've been trying to write. Every college workshop that I ever did, I'd have one of those stories and I would tell it from a totally different point of view. I would make it completely fictional. So it's not like I'm literally working on the same drafts, but those ideas. And finally, I realized that, first of all, I wrote them actually for the story collection. They were what I felt was missing. They were the kind of the through thread of the collection that makes it not just a pile of stories, but also an investigation of, it's a self-conscious move, basically. You know, I'm putting them in there and it raises the question of why then I would be the author who would then write these stories that have nothing to do with it, but why am I writing this story about, you know, Johann Sebastian Bach living in someone's living room in 2001? That story might mean something different knowing my family history, knowing who I am as a writer, which is, of course, a certain way I'm positioning myself in here. There's a lot more going on than this, just these stories. So I wrote them for the collection. And I realized as I put them in, the only way that I could really tell these stories was to not tell them straight, but to be honest about the struggle of telling these stories, and that I've been given this information. I doubt a lot of it. It's a little bit too good to be true, a lot of this stuff. My father is a poet. He makes stuff up. You know, things change over time. There's what I want to believe versus what's maybe more realistic. And so that was the only way I could really tell them, was to have the stories be about that doubt.
Well, let me ask you a question, because you, of course, the skepticism is understandable given these are stories that are passed down and repeated, not always probably by the same person. And then the fallibility of memory, story around the poisoning of the soldiers, your grandmother can't remember which army, for instance, they're coming from. But did you ever come to a point where you found that there was actual fudging of the facts by someone who had told you the story, for instance?
Well, you know, the one thing I know is that, like, if you ask my father the story on two different days, it's two different stories. So it's like, well, something is false. Whether it's all false, I don't know. You know, basically, at some point, I really do want to actually write a full-on nonfiction book about this, because their story only gets more and more bizarre. Like, there's some stuff that, you know, certain details that were like just too crazy to even put in these that actually are some of the ones that I really do think are true, probably investigable, is that a word? I can see where that could go. And for now, you know, I wrote them kind of as fiction. They were published together in Harper's, and Harper's took them as nonfiction. And then they had to go through sort of this fact-checking sieve at Harper's, which was really interesting. I was still allowed to basically say, this is the story I was told, I don't know. That part, can't fact-check that, but then I'm saying something about, you know, what year my grandfather was born. They had to investigate all this stuff. It was really interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Well, before we depart from your family history, since I do think it haunts the entire collection, but what particularly haunts the entire collection is the the way your family falls on both sides of the conflict in World War II.
So right. Okay. Yeah.
And also the way I feel like that, it feels like that haunts you.
Yeah.
And so if you would be willing to talk just a little bit about your grandfather.
No, I can.
Who was briefly married to your grandmother.
They were briefly married and they were first cousins, which has been kind of like, it's not something you necessarily want to go around saying, but it's the truth. The deal with my grandfather is that he was a member of parliament in Hungary, and he was also the editor of one of the major newspapers, which, like, those two jobs shouldn't go together. But what we definitely know for sure, this is indisputable, he, while my grandmother was a liberal and an author, she was an actress before that, she was protecting a lot of her Jewish friends. My grandfather was the author of the second set of anti-Jewish laws in Hungary. And they were, you know, they were not genocidal laws particularly, but they put a lot of people out of work. They kind of put down the red carpet for the Germans, wittingly or not. And later, he was very anti-German and started this resistance radio station in the mountains and was jailed by the Gestapo. And it's really, what's really unclear to me is whether when he, turned and worked for the resistance, whether that was any change of heart on the Jewish issue or whether it was just anti-German.
Right.
You know, he was a nationalist. He didn't like the Jewish refugees coming in. Then he didn't like the Germans coming in. Or was he, as my father always told me, he was really young. He was like 30 when this all happened. I mean, it's like this very young guy in parliament. And, you know, was he sort of, my father always said was, you know, he was kind of forced into this. He was trying to find a solution because the other people's solutions were worse. This is what he came up with. The more I investigate, I really don't think that's true. And, you know, it's weird. I knew him. He eventually ended up in Hawaii. And I knew him as a kid, and he was this really funny old man. He was a yoga instructor who sold real estate, and he was like, would stand on his head in his Hawaiian shirts, and he was this like total goofball. It's really hard to reconcile that with like what I know.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I can say very confidently that I really want to be on your shoulder when you try to puzzle this out in the book that you do to grapple. I know you've talked about wanting to grapple with this more. Like, I love the image of you with your grandmother's 40 books that you can't read.
Yeah, yeah.
And that mystery and then this conflict. Like, it's so fascinating to me.
I think that's it. I think one of the reasons that I want to write this book, it's not just that I want to investigate, and it's not that I feel like everyone needs to listen to my particular family story or something like that. It's that I think why it might appeal to readers is that so many of us are in a situation where like people didn't know their grandparents. There's some mystery in your family and there's someone that maybe you feel some connection with, some grandparent who died when you were younger and you're just never going to know them. And in my case, you know, that is the situation. My grandmother was run over by a bus when I was a baby. She is the person in my family who I have the most in common with. We're the authors in the family. Mm-hmm. Other things too, you know, like she was an actress. I acted a lot in college, just all these things. I didn't know her. And I'm in the somewhat unique position of having 40 novels by her sitting on my shelf and history that I can go and investigate and puzzles to solve that I can actually solve. Right. And I think that, there might be something to relate to in that, even if just through wish fulfillment for some people, that like I'm in an enviable position to be able to do this, even if I know that 90% of what I'm going to find on my grandfather's side is really disturbing.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to author Rebecca Mackay about her short story collection, Music for Wartime. So, Rebecca, do you have a section of prose you could read for our listeners?
Yeah, I could read something really strange. Does that sound good?
That sounds awesome.
Okay, here's what I'm going to do. It's a story called Couple of Lovers on a Red Background. And it's got nothing to do with what we were just talking about, which is, maybe that's good. And I'm going to read the beginning, and then I'm going to like skip ahead and read a paragraph from the middle, and then I'm just going to leave it hanging. All right. And it's basically a weird sort of love story. This woman ends up with Johann Sebastian Bach living in her apartment. I've been calling him Bach so far, at least in my head. But now that he's started wearing my ex-husband's clothes and learned to work the coffee maker, I feel it's time to call him Johann. I said it out loud once when I needed him to get off the couch before the super came up, but he didn't respond. He went to the vacuum closet only because I practically carried him. No easy task pushing someone so big and sweaty, even with the weight he's lost since he got here. I would take him out for some real German food, but if there is one thing I've learned from the movies about caring for transplanted historical people, it's never to take them out in public among the taxis and police and department store mannequins. I've kept the curtains closed and the TV unplugged, but I did introduce him to the stereo so he'd have something to do while I'm gone. I'm proud of how I did it. I dug my angel music box out of the Christmas decorations and played it for him. He seemed familiar, so I pointed back and forth between the angel box and the CD player, and then put on some Handel. He was not at all scared, and now he's pushing buttons and changing discs like he was raised on Sony. At first, I only let him have Baroque, but we've been moving up in history. He's fond of Mozart, but for some reason, Tchaikovsky makes him giggle. When I played him Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, I thought he was going to wet the couch. 5 minutes later, he went to the piano and played the main part from memory, busted out laughing at certain phrases. If such a thing is possible, he played it sarcastically. He has a laugh, incidentally, like you'd expect from a pot-smoking 13-year-old. On the phone the other day, my mother said, "Who's that laughing over there? At least she thinks I'm dating again." And then what I'm going to do is skip ahead. So he's living there for a while. We find out how he got there. He, like, crawled out of her piano one day. Things progress, okay? Which is all to say, he's not bad looking. It makes you think. Technically, he's a married man, but even more technically, his second wife died 300 years ago. And it's not as if I can go out on dates now and leave him alone, and I can't bring anyone back here. Then there's this. He had 20 children. He's clearly very fertile, and any child of his would be a musical genius. His sons certainly were, and his daughters might have been, given the chance. Could that be the reason this happened, so I can have his daughter and give her a decent shot at life? The question, then, is how to seduce an 18th century German.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to author Rebecca Mackay about her short story collection, Music for Wartime. You've been listening to Rebecca Mackay read from Music for Wartime. I'm really glad you chose that story because this collection is actually really funny and really fun, and it doesn't feel... It feels very organic, the exploration of suffering, of history and pain, and also all of this sort of rollicking, fantastical and fun scenarios at the same time. Somehow I feel like it coheres.
Good. I'm glad you said that, because I think, you know, sometimes I get to talking about it in interviews and stuff, and it's like we're talking about war and death, and it makes it sound like this really serious collection. And there's a story in there about reality TV, and
Well, that's a perfect example, that story, the November story.
The November story, yeah.
Which is one of my favorites, because it is really, really funny, but it also feels like it's asking a similar question as the legends.
Right.
Like, the truthfulness of narrative. What can we know of other people? And because here we have, like, someone who's working in a reality TV show, and they're forcing people to act certain ways or coaxing different reactions, but then editing it in an entirely different way, depending on what just like we would imagine on reality TV.
Yeah.
And then even editing their own lives, essentially, when they come home from work.
Right. It's like carrying over into her personal life, which is disastrous. I'm really glad you picked up on that. It certainly speaks to the big themes of the collection in that it's a reality show about artists, like pitting artists against each other and eliminating them. And they're trying to make art in this very artificial circumstance, under all this stress. It's a very different kind of war than, you know, the literal wars in a couple of the other stories. It's also very much about, it very much speaks to the theme of truth and how we make the truth and how we question the truth.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to author Rebecca Mackay about her short story collection, Music for Wartime. Back to the story that you just read, the love affair with Bach, who comes out of the piano. that is one of many iterations of the theme of music and art. There's a repetition of painters, of actors, and of
writers.
And writers and musicians throughout the piece. Is this simply because this is your family?
Yeah, this is really it. So like early on in my writing career, I'm not talking about like, you know, college and a couple of years after, I really felt like to write serious fiction, I needed to write about like gritty urban stuff with sort of uneducated characters. I have no idea where I got this idea, but I felt like that's serious fiction. And the problem is, like, that's just not how I grew up. Like, my parents were college professors. Everyone in my family, even beyond my grandparents, everyone's either an academic or an artist of some kind. My sister is a musician. You know, like, we have actors. We have, that's all I know. And that's who my friends are. And that's, you know, the world I live in. And I just gave myself permission to start writing about that early on. You know, I can write about kind of nerdy, geeky, artsy people. That's fine. I think some of the stories in here did come about, you know, I've started focusing on the theme, writing to the theme a little bit, and felt like, for instance, I really felt like I needed a story about that was deeply about music in here, that was really about a musician, not like a, I mean, Bach is a musician, but you know what I mean. And so I have a story in there called Cross that's about this cello player in a string quartet. It gets really deep into the descriptions of music, which I felt comfortable writing about. I wanted to write about, but it, you know, it felt like it was a missing piece in the book until that point. But there are pieces, many of the pieces I have that are not in the book are also about academics or artists or they just, you know, I think they lead interesting lives.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff to write about there.
Well, there's this interesting thing that happens, and I don't know if it's a happy accident or if it was intentional on your part in forging the collection, but having stories about actors and having stories about refugees who are leading a second life,
right,
essentially, it doubles down on the idea of what do we know?
Mm-hmm.
Because you have people leaving a life and coming into a new life, literally in the briefcase with the stolen identity.
Yeah.
And you have family members who are starting new lives, including your father, who I believe was an adult refugee himself.
He was 21. He was partway through college. And you're really onto something there. I mean, I think it may be slightly subconscious on my part, but that's absolutely accurate. And I think I've always had in my mind this question of what it means to start over, you know, what it means to just kind of create a new identity for yourself, partly because my father was a refugee and we had kind of a constant stream of refugees living in our basement throughout the 1980s in suburban Chicago. People would get out and live in our basement for a few months and then, you know, get their visa and be on their way. And, you know, I think that's a theme in my other work too. I mean, the borrower, they're not central to the story, but there's a whole theater company living upstairs from this woman, who's the main character. And in The 100-Year House, it's very much, in many ways, a story about taking on new identities and reinventing yourself. It's also very much a story about artists. It's set at an artist's colony.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think basically what I'm saying is you're right. Smart point.
Let me ask you about the Museum of the Dearly Departed. To me, that if I were to guess, I would guess that more than any story was written for the collection.
Oh, yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it feels like it unifies all of the threads, the family legends and the contemporary concerns that are happening in the collection.
And it's the last story in the book. And even to the point where I think there are little pieces of some of the other stories in there. It's basically the story concerns an apartment building in Chicago where almost all of the residents have died in the night from this gas leak. And the only survivors are this elderly Hungarian couple, which, of course, you're reading this story. It's the last in the book. You know there's a connection to my family. Like, you know I'm talking about more than just the story, although I published it, you know, on its own as well.
Right.
And this woman who's coming back in to sort through an apartment and sort through stuff because she has inherited it, but she didn't know that her fiance was still in love with and in touch with his ex-wife, whose apartment it was. And she actually thought she was dead previously. The ex and her fiance have both died. She, through a weird legal twist, has ended up with the apartment. And she's going through it trying to make sense of this woman's life and also who her fiance really was, that he would betray her in this way, why he still was in touch with this woman. And then she's also interacting with this Hungarian couple who, you know, for them, the fact that it was a gas leak and this woman, this elderly woman, had very narrowly escaped the gas chambers in World War II. This woman really feels like the whole thing is her fault and it's fate catching up with her. And I think in a lot of ways it's a story about, you know, this woman, Melanie, trying to make sense of all these stories in the same way that I've been as a writer, as a person, trying to make sense of all these stories that I've been given by my family and the stories that I'm telling. I'm trying to make sense of them.
You talked about potentially at some point grappling in a deeper way with your family history and memoir, mm-hmm. potentially. Is there another project that's coming up before that you're working on?
Yeah, I'm working on a novel already.
You are?
Would
you be willing to tip your hand a little bit about it?
No, I can. I can totally. I have, you know, I feel like it's dangerous to talk about it too much, but I have my elevator pitch, line. Yeah. The working title is The Great Believers, and I don't know if that's really going to end up on the book jacket or not, but it's a story that's set partly in Chicago in the 1980s against the backdrop of the AIDS crisis. And it's set partly in modern day Paris, where a woman who's a survivor of that scene where a lot of her friends died in the 80s is now going over to try to find her daughter who she's estranged from. Mm-hmm. But basically trying at the same time to make sense of the stuff that happened in the 80s. So I'm going back and forth between those two time periods. And there's also at the same time a lot of talk about Paris in the 20s and the art scene then. I'm having a lot of, this sounds like really weird to say about a book that's basically about AIDS. I'm having a lot of fun with it. I think I have, despite what's going on in the book, I have some really joyful, fun characters, and that's been fun to work with.
Well, it was great having you on Between the Covers today, Rebecca.
Thank you.
We are talking today to Rebecca Mackay about her story collection, Music for Wartime. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor, along with North Portland Community Building Group, Proper, of the We Can Do It Together community concert. Local politicians, community activists, faith groups, and artists will join in a day of unity, song, and prayer in Kenton Park on Saturday, August 8th, from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. This concert will feature a variety of local artists that will rally for unity in this time of unrest. Again, that's the We Can Do It Together community concert, Saturday, August 8th, from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m.